recovery from the Great Recession. Between 2014 and 2016, median wages leapt to an all-time high. Even more significant is what has happened at the bottom of the scale. Both the left and the right have long expressed cynicism about anti-poverty programs, as in Ronald Reagan's famous quip, "Some years ago, the federal government declared war on poverty, and poverty won." In reality, poverty is losing. The sociologist Christopher Jenks has calculated that when the benefits from the hidden welfare state are added up, and the cost of living is estimated in a way that takes into account the improving quality and falling price of consumer goods, the poverty rate has fallen in the past 50 years by more than three-quarters, and in 2013 stood at 4.8%. Three other analyses have come to the same conclusion. Data from one of them, by the economists Bruce Meyer and James Sullivan, are shown in the upper line in Figure 9-6. The progress stagnated around the time of the Great Recession, but it picked up in 2015 and 2016, not shown in the graph, when middle-class income reached a record high and the poverty rate showed its largest drop since 1999. And in yet another unsung accomplishment, the poorest of the poor, the unsheltered homeless, fell in number between 2007 and 2015 by almost a third, despite the Great Recession. The lower line in Figure 9-6 highlights the fourth way in which inequality measures understate the progress of the lower and middle classes in rich countries. Income is just a means to an end, a way of paying for things that people need, want, and like, or as economists gracelessly call it, consumption. When poverty is defined in terms of what people consume rather than what they earn, we find that the American poverty rate has declined by 90% since 1960, from 30% of the population to just 3%. The two forces that have famously increased inequality in income have at the same time decreased inequality in what matters. The first, globalization, may produce winners and losers in income, but in consumption it makes almost everyone a winner. Asian factories, container ships, and efficient retailing bring goods to the masses that were formerly luxuries for the rich. In 2005, the economist Jason Furman estimated that Walmart saved the typical American family $2,300 a year. The second force, technology, continually revolutionizes the meaning of income, as we saw in the discussion of the paradox of value in Chapter 8. A dollar today, no matter how heroically adjusted for inflation, buys far more betterment of life than a dollar yesterday. It buys things that didn't exist, like refrigeration, electricity, toilets, vaccinations, telephones, contraception, and air travel, and it transforms things that do exist, such as a party line patched by a switchboard operator, to a smartphone with unlimited talk time. Together, technology and globalization have transformed what it means to be a poor person, at least in developed countries. The old stereotype of poverty was an emaciated pauper in rags. Today, the poor are likely to be as overweight as their employers and dressed in the same fleece, sneakers, and jeans. The poor used to be called the have-nots. In 2011, more than 95% of American households below the poverty line had electricity, running water, flush toilets, a refrigerator, a stove, and a color TV. A century and a half before, the Rothschilds, Astors, and Vanderbilts had none of these things. Almost half of the households below the poverty line had a dishwasher, 60% had a computer, around two-thirds had a washing machine and a clothes dryer, and more than 80% had an air conditioner, a video recorder, and a cell phone. In the golden age of economic equality in which I grew up, middle-class haves had few or none of these things. As a result, the most precious resources of all—time, freedom, and worthy experiences—are rising across the board, a topic we will explore in Chapter 17. The rich have gotten richer, but their lives haven't gotten that much better. Warren Buffett may have more air conditioners than most people, or better ones, But by historical standards, the fact that a majority of poor Americans even have an air conditioner is astonishing. When the Gini index is calculated over consumption rather than income, it has remained shallow or flat. Inequality in self-reported happiness in the American population has actually declined. And though I find it distasteful, even grotesque, to celebrate declining Ginis for life, health, and education, as if killing off the healthiest and keeping the smartest out of school would be good for humanity, they have in fact declined for the right reasons. The lives of the poor are improving more rapidly than the lives of the rich. To acknowledge that the lives of the lower and middle classes of developed countries have improved in recent decades is not to deny the formidable problems facing 21st century economies. Though disposable income has increased, the pace of the increase is slow, and the resulting lack of consumer demand may be dragging down the economy as a whole. The hardships faced by one sector of the population, middle-aged, less educated, non-urban white Americans, are real and tragic, manifested in higher rates of drug overdose, Chapter 12, and suicide, Chapter 18. Advances in robotics threaten to make millions of additional jobs obsolete. Truck drivers, for example, make up the most common occupation in a majority of states, and self-driving vehicles may send them the way of scriveners, wheelwrights, and switchboard operators. Education, a major driver of economic mobility, is not keeping up with the demands of modern economies. Tertiary education has soared in cost, defying the inexpensification of almost every other good, and in poor American neighborhoods, primary and secondary education are unconscionably substandard. Many parts of the American tax system are regressive, and money buys too much political influence. Perhaps most damaging, the impression that the modern economy has left most people behind encourages Luddite and beggar-thy-neighbor policies that would make everyone worse off. Still, a narrow focus on income inequality and a nostalgia for the mid-20th century Great Compression are misplaced. The modern world can continue to improve, even if the Gini index or top income shares stay high, as they may well do, because the forces that lifted them are not going away. Americans cannot be forced to buy Pontiacs instead of Priuses. The Harry Potter books will not be kept out of the hands of the world's children just because they turn J.K. Rowling into a billionaire. It makes little sense to make tens of millions of poor Americans pay more for clothing to save tens of thousands of jobs in the apparel industry, nor does it make sense in the long term to have people do boring and dangerous jobs that could be carried out more effectively by machines just to give them remunerable work. Rather than tilting at inequality per se, it may be more constructive to target the specific problems lumped with it. An obvious priority is to boost the rate of economic growth, since it would increase everyone's slice of the pie and provide more pie to redistribute. The trends of the past century, and a survey of the world's countries, point to governments playing an increasing role in both. They are uniquely suited to invest in education, basic research, and infrastructure, to underwrite health and retirement benefits, relieving American corporations of their enervating mandate to provide social services, and to supplement incomes to a level above their market price, which for millions of people may decline even as overall wealth rises. The next step in the historic trend toward greater social spending may be a universal basic income, or its close relative, a negative income tax. The idea has been brooded for decades, and its day may be coming. Despite its socialist aroma, the idea has been championed by economists such as Milton Friedman, politicians such as Richard Nixon, and states such as Alaska that are associated with the political right, and today analysts across the political spectrum are toying with it. Though implementing a universal basic income is far from easy, the numbers have to add up, and incentives for education, work, and risk-taking have to be maintained, its promise cannot be ignored. It could rationalize the kludgy patchwork of the hidden welfare state, and it could turn the slow-motion disaster of robots replacing workers into a horn of plenty. Many of the jobs that robots will take over are jobs that people don't particularly enjoy. And the dividend in productivity, safety, and leisure could be a boon to humanity as long as it is widely shared. The specter of anomie and meaninglessness is probably exaggerated. According to studies of regions that have experimented with a guaranteed income, and it could be met with public jobs that markets won't support and robots can't do, or with new opportunities in meaningful volunteering and other forms of effective altruism. The net effect might be to reduce inequality, but that would be a side effect of raising everyone's standard of living, particularly that of the economically vulnerable. Income inequality, in sum, is not a counterexample to human progress, and we are not living in a dystopia of falling incomes that has reversed the centuries-long rise in prosperity. Nor does it call for smashing the robots, raising the drawbridge, switching to socialism, or bringing back the 50s. Let me sum up my complicated story on a complicated topic. Inequality is not the same as poverty, and it is not a fundamental dimension of human flourishing. In comparisons of well-being across countries, it pales in importance next to overall wealth. An increase in inequality is not necessarily bad. As societies escape from universal poverty, they are bound to become more unequal. And the uneven surge may be repeated when a society discovers new sources of wealth. Nor is a decrease in inequality always good. The most effective levelers of economic disparities are epidemics, massive wars, violent revolutions, and state collapse. For all that, the long-term trend in history since the Enlightenment is for everyone's fortunes to rise. In addition to generating massive amounts of wealth, modern societies have devoted an increasing proportion of that wealth to benefiting the less well-off. As globalization and technology have lifted billions out of poverty and created a global middle class, international and global inequality have decreased, at the same time that they enrich elites whose analytical, creative, or financial impact has global reach. The fortunes of the lower classes in developed countries have not improved nearly as much, but they have improved often because their members rise into the upper classes. The improvements are enhanced by social spending and by the falling cost and rising quality of the things people want. In some ways, the world has become less equal, but in more ways, the world's people have become better off. Chapter 10. The Environment. But is progress sustainable? A common response to the good news about our health, wealth, and sustenance is that it cannot continue. As we infest the world with our teeming numbers, guzzle the earth's bounty heedless of its finitude, and foul our nests with pollution and waste, we are hastening an environmental day of reckoning. If overpopulation, resource depletion, and pollution don't finish us off, then climate change will. As in the chapter on inequality, I won't pretend that all the trends are positive, or that the problems facing us are minor. But I will present a way of thinking about these problems that differs from the lugubrious conventional wisdom and offers a constructive alternative to the radicalism or fatalism it encourages. The key idea is that environmental problems, like other problems, are solvable given the right knowledge. To be sure, the very idea that there are environmental problems cannot be taken for granted. From the vantage point of an individual, the Earth seems infinite, and our effects on it inconsequential. From the vantage points of science, the view is more troubling. The microscopic vantage point reveals pollutants that insidiously poison us and the species we admire and depend on. The macroscopic one reveals effects on ecosystems that may be imperceptible one action at a time, but add up to tragic despoilation. Beginning in the 1960s, the environmental movement grew out of scientific knowledge from ecology, public health, and earth and atmospheric sciences, and a romantic reverence for nature. The movement made the health of the planet a permanent priority on humanity's agenda, and as we shall see, It deserves credit for substantial achievements, another form of human progress. Ironically, many voices in the traditional environmental movement refuse to acknowledge that progress, or even that human progress is a worthy aspiration. In this chapter, I will present a newer conception of environmentalism, which shares the goal of protecting the air and water, species and ecosystems, but is grounded in Enlightenment optimism rather than romantic declinism. Starting in the 1970s, the mainstream environmental movement latched onto a quasi-religious ideology, greenism, which can be found in the manifestos of activists as diverse as Al Gore, the Unabomber, and Pope Francis. Green ideology begins with an image of the earth as a pristine ingenue, which has been defiled by human rapacity. As Francis put it in his 2015 encyclical, Laudato Si, Praise be to you. Our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life, who now cries out to us because of the harm we have inflicted on her. The harm, according to this narrative, has been inexorably worsening. The earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth. The root cause is the Enlightenment commitment to reason, science, and progress. Scientific and technological progress cannot be equated with the progress of humanity and history, wrote Francis. The way to a better future lies elsewhere, namely in an appreciation of the mysterious network of relations between things and, of course, the treasure of Christian spiritual experience. Unless we repent our sins by degrowth, deindustrialization, and a rejection of the false gods of science, technology, and progress, humanity will face a ghastly reckoning in an environmental judgment day. As with many apocalyptic movements, greenism is laced with misanthropy, including an indifference to starvation, an indulgence in ghoulish fantasies of a depopulated planet, and Nazi-like comparisons of human beings to vermin, pathogens, and cancer. For example, Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society wrote, "We need to radically and intelligently reduce human populations to fewer than 1 billion. Curing a body of cancer requires radical and invasive therapy, and therefore, curing the biosphere of the human virus will also require a radical and invasive approach." Recently, an alternative approach to environmental protection has been championed by John Asafu-Anje, Jesse Ausubel, Andrew Bomford, Stuart Brand, Ruth DeFries, Nancy Knowlton, Ted Nordhaus, Michael Schellenberger, and others. It has been called eco-modernism, eco-pragmatism, earth optimism, and the blue-green or turquoise movement, though we can also think of it as Enlightenment environmentalism or humanistic environmentalism. Eco-modernism begins with the realization that some degree of pollution is an inescapable consequence of the second law of thermodynamics. When people use energy to create a zone of structure in their bodies and homes, they must increase entropy elsewhere in the environment in the form of waste, pollution, and other forms of disorder. The human species has always been ingenious at doing this. That's what differentiates us from other mammals, and it has never lived in harmony with the environment. When native peoples first set foot in an ecosystem, they typically hunted large animals to extinction and often burned and cleared vast swaths of forest. A dirty secret of the conservation movement is that wilderness preserves are set up only after indigenous peoples have been decimated or forcibly removed from them, including the national parks in the United States and the Serengeti in East Africa. As the environmental historian William Cronin writes, "Wilderness is not a pristine sanctuary. It is itself a product of civilization." When humans took up farming, they became more disruptive still. According to the paleoclimatologist William Ruddiman, the adoption of wet rice cultivation in Asia some 5,000 years ago may have released so much methane into the atmosphere from rotting vegetation as to have changed the climate. A good case can be made, he suggests, that the people in the Iron Age and even the late Stone Age had a much greater per capita impact on the Earth's landscape than the average modern-day person. And as Brand has pointed out, Chapter 7, natural farming is a contradiction in terms. Whenever he hears the words natural food, he is tempted to rail, "No product of agriculture is the slightest bit natural to an ecologist. You take a nice, complex ecosystem, chop it into rectangles, clear it to the ground, and hammer it into perpetual early succession. You bust it sod, flatten it flat, and drench it with vast quantities of constant water. Then you populate it with uniform monocrops of profoundly damaged plants incapable of living on their own. Every food plant is a pathetic, narrow specialist in one skill, inbred for thousands of years to a state of genetic idiocy. Those plants are so fragile, they had to domesticate humans just to take endless care of them." A second realization of the eco-modernist movement is that industrialization has been good for humanity. It has fed billions, doubled lifespans, slashed extreme poverty, and, by replacing muscle with machinery, made it easier to end slavery, emancipate women, and educate children. Chapters 7, 15, and 17. It has allowed people to read at night, live where they want, stay warm in winter, see the world and multiply human contact. Any costs in pollution and habitat loss have to be weighed against these gifts. As the economist Robert Frank has put it, there is an optimal amount of pollution in the environment, just as there is an optimal amount of dirt in your house. Cleaner is better, but not at the expense of everything else in life. The third premise is that the trade-off that pits human well-being against environmental damage can be renegotiated by technology. How to enjoy more calories, lumens, BTUs, bits, and miles with less pollution and land is itself a technological problem, and one that the world is increasingly solving. Economists speak of the environmental Kuznets curve, a counterpart to the U-shaped arc for inequality, as a function of economic growth. As countries first develop, they prioritize growth over environmental purity, but as they get richer, their thoughts turn to the environment. If people can afford electricity only at the cost of some smog, they'll live with the smog. But when they can afford both electricity and clean air, they'll spring for the clean air. This can happen all the faster as technology makes cars and factories and power plants cleaner, and thus makes clean air more affordable. Economic growth bends the environmental Kuznets curve by advances not just in technology, but in values. Some environmental concerns are entirely practical. People complain about smog in their city, or green space getting paved over. But other concerns are more spiritual. The fate of the black rhinoceros and the well-being of our descendants in the year 2525 are significant moral concerns. But worrying about them now is something of a luxury. As societies get richer and people no longer think about putting food on the table or a roof over their heads, their values climb a hierarchy of needs, and the scope of their concern expands in space and time. Ronald Inglehart and Christian Veltzel, using data from the World Values Survey, have found that people with stronger emancipative values, tolerance, equality, freedom of thought and speech, which tend to go with affluence and education, are also more likely to recycle and to pressure governments and businesses into protecting the environment. Eco-pessimists commonly dismiss this entire way of thinking as the faith that technology will save us. In fact, it is a skepticism that the status quo will doom us, that knowledge will be frozen in its current state and people will robotically persist in their current behavior regardless of circumstances. Indeed, a naive faith in stasis has repeatedly led to prophecies of environmental doomsdays that never happened. The first is the population bomb, which, as we saw in Chapter 7, diffused itself. When countries get richer and better educated, they pass through what demographers call the demographic transition. First, death rates decline as nutrition and health improve. This does swell the population, but that is hardly something to bewail. As Johan Norberg notes, It happens not because people in poor countries start breeding like rabbits, but because they stop dying like flies. In any case, the increase is temporary. Birth rates peak and then decline for at least two reasons. Parents no longer breed large broods as insurance against some of their children dying, and women, when they become better educated, marry later and delay having children. Figure 10-1 shows that the world population growth rate peaked at 2.1% a year in 1962, fell to 1.2% by 2010, and will probably fall to less than 0.5% by 2050 and be close to zero around 2070, when the population is projected to level off and then decline. Fertility rates have fallen most noticeably in developed regions like Europe and Japan, but they can suddenly collapse, often to demographers' surprise, in other parts of the world. Despite the widespread belief that Muslim societies are resistant to the social changes that have transformed the West and will be indefinitely rocked by youth quakes, Muslim countries have seen a 40% decline in fertility over the past three decades, including a 70% drop in Iran and 60% drops in Bangladesh and in seven Arab countries. The other scare from the 1960s was that the world would run out of resources. But resources just refused to run out. The 1980s came and went without the famines that were supposed to starve tens of millions of Americans and billions of people worldwide. Then the year 1992 passed, and, contrary to projections from the 1972 bestseller, The Limits to Growth, and similar philippics, the world did not exhaust its aluminum, copper, chromium, gold, nickel, tin, tungsten, or zinc. In 1980, Paul Ehrlich famously bet the economist Julian Simon that five of these metals would become scarcer and hence more expensive by the end of the decade. He lost all five bets. Indeed, most metals and minerals are cheaper today than they were in 1960. From the 1970s to the early 2000s, news magazines periodically illustrated cover stories on the world's oil supply with a gas gauge pointing to empty. In 2013, The Atlantic ran a cover story about the fracking revolution entitled, "We Will Never Run Out of Oil." And then there are rare earths like yttrium, scandium, europium, and lanthanum, which you may remember from the periodic table in your chemistry classroom, or from the Tom Lehrer song, The Elements. These metals are a critical component of magnets, fluorescent lights, video screens, catalysts, lasers, capacitors, optical glass, and other high-tech applications. When they started running out, we were warned, there would be critical shortages, a collapse of the technology industry, and perhaps war with China, the source of 95% of the world's supply. That's what led to the great europium crisis of the late 20th century, when the world ran out of the critical ingredient in the red phosphor dots in the cathode ray tubes in color televisions and computer monitors, and society was divided between the haves, who hoarded the last working color TVs, and the angry have-nots, who were forced to make do with black and white. What? You never heard of it? Among the reasons there was no such crisis was that cathode ray tubes were superseded by liquid crystal displays made of common elements. And the rare earths war? In reality, when China squeezed its exports in 2010, not because of shortages but as a geopolitical and mercantilist weapon, other countries started extracting rare earths from their own mines, recycling them from industrial waste, and re-engineering products so they no longer needed them. When predictions of apocalyptic resource shortages repeatedly fail to come true, one has to conclude either that humanity has miraculously escaped from certain death again and again like a Hollywood action hero, or that there is a flaw in the thinking that predicts apocalyptic resource shortages. The flaw has been pointed out many times. Humanity does not suck resources from the earth like a straw in a milkshake until a gurgle tells it that the container is empty. Instead, as the most easily extracted supply of a resource becomes scarcer, its price rises, encouraging people to conserve it, get at the less accessible deposits, or find cheaper and more plentiful substitutes. Indeed, it's a fallacy to think that people need resources in the first place. They need ways of growing food, moving around, lighting their homes, displaying information and other sources of well-being. They satisfy these needs with ideas, with recipes, formulas, techniques, blueprints, and algorithms for manipulating the physical world to give them what they want. The human mind, with its recursive combinatorial power, can explore an infinite space of ideas, and is not limited by the quantity of any particular kind of stuff in the ground. When one idea no longer works, another can take its place. This doesn't defy the laws of probability, but obeys them. Why should the laws of nature have allowed exactly one physically possible way of satisfying a human desire, no more and no less? Admittedly, this way of thinking does not sit well with the ethic of sustainability. In Figure 10-2, the cartoonist Randall Monroe illustrates what's wrong with this vogue word and sacred value. The doctrine of sustainability assumes that the current rate of use of a resource may be extrapolated into the future until it rams into a ceiling. The implication is that we must switch to a renewable resource that can be replenished at the rate we use it, indefinitely. In reality, societies have always abandoned a resource for a better one long before the old one was exhausted. It's often said that the Stone Age did not end because the world ran out of stones, and that has been true of energy as well. Plenty of wood and hay remained to be exploited when the world shifted to coal. Ausubel notes, coal abounded when oil rose. Oil abounds now as methane, natural gas, rises. As we will see, gas in turn may be replaced by energy sources still lower in carbon, well before the last cubic foot goes up in a blue flame. The supply of food, too, has grown exponentially, as we saw in Chapter 7, even though no single method of growing it has ever been sustainable. In The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis, the geographer Ruth DeFries describes the sequence as ratchet, hatchet, pivot. People discover a way of growing more food, and the population ratchets upward. The method fails to keep up with the demand or develops unpleasant side effects, and the hatchet falls. People then pivot to a new method. At various times, farmers have pivoted to slash and burn horticulture, night soil, a euphemism for human feces, crop rotation, guano, saltpeter, ground-up bison bones, chemical fertilizer, hybrid crops, pesticides, and the Green Revolution. Future pivots may include genetically modified organisms, hydroponics, aeroponics, urban vertical farms, robotic harvesting, meat cultured in vitro, artificial intelligence, algorithms fed by GPS and biosensors, the recovery of energy and fertilizer from sewage, aquaculture with fish that eat tofu instead of other fish, and who knows what else. As long as people are allowed to indulge their ingenuity. The water is one resource that people will never pivot away from. Farmers could save massive amounts if they switched to Israeli-style precision farming. And if the world develops abundant carbon-free energy sources, a topic we will explore later, it could get what it needs by desalinating seawater. Not only have the disasters prophesied by 1970s greenism failed to take place, but improvements that it deemed impossible have taken place. As the world has gotten richer and crested the environmental curve, nature has begun to rebound. Pope Francis's immense pile of filth is the vision of someone who has woken up thinking it's 1965, the era of belching smokestacks, waterfalls of sewage, rivers catching fire, and jokes about New Yorkers not liking to breathe air they can't see. Figure 10-3 shows that since 1970, when the Environmental Protection Agency was established, the United States has slashed its emissions of 5 air pollutants by almost 2/3. Over the same period, the population grew by more than 40%, and those people drove twice as many miles and became 2.5 times richer. Energy use has leveled off, and even carbon dioxide emissions have turned a corner, a point to which we will return. The declines don't just reflect an offshoring of heavy industry to the developing world, because the bulk of energy use and emissions comes from transportation, heating, and electricity generation, which cannot be outsourced. Rather, they mainly reflect gains in efficiency and emission control. These diverging curves refute both the orthodox green claim that only degrowth can curb pollution, and the orthodox right-wing claim that environmental protection must sabotage economic growth and people's standard of living. Many of the improvements can be seen with the naked eye. Cities are less often shrouded in purple-brown haze, and London no longer has the fog, actually coal smoke, that was immortalized in Impressionist paintings, Gothic novels, the Gershwin song, and a brand of raincoats. Urban waterways that had been left for dead, including Puget Sound, Chesapeake Bay, Boston Harbor, Lake Erie, and the Hudson, Potomac, Chicago, Charles, Seine, Rhine, and Thames rivers, the last described by Disraeli as a Stygian pool reeking with ineffable and intolerable horrors, have been recolonized by fish, birds, marine mammals, and sometimes swimmers. Suburbanites are seeing wolves, foxes, bears, bobcats, badgers, deer, ospreys, wild turkeys, and bald eagles. As agriculture becomes more efficient, Chapter 7, farmland returns to temperate forest, as any hiker knows who has stumbled upon a stone wall incongruously running through a New England woodland. The tropical forests are still alarmingly being cut down. Between the middle of the 20th century and the turn of the 21st, the rate fell by 2/3, figure 10-4. Deforestation of the world's largest tropical forest, the Amazon, peaked in 1995, and from 2004 to 2013, the rate fell by 4/5. The time-lagged decline of deforestation in the tropics is one sign that environmental protection is spreading from developed countries to the rest of the world. The world's progress can be tracked in a report card called the Environmental Performance Index, a composite of indicators of the quality of air, water, forests, fisheries, farms, and natural habitats. Out of 180 countries that have been tracked for a decade or more, all but 2 show an improvement. The wealthier the country, on average, the cleaner its environment. The Nordic countries were cleanest, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and several sub-Saharan African countries the most compromised. 2 of the deadliest forms of pollution, contaminated drinking water and indoor cooking smoke, are afflictions of poor countries. But as poor countries have gotten richer in recent decades, they are escaping these blights. The proportion of the world's population that drinks tainted water has fallen by 5/8, the proportion breathing cooking smoke by 1/3. As Indira Gandhi said, poverty is the greatest polluter. The epitome of environmental insults is the oil spill from tanker ships, which coats pristine beaches with toxic black sludge and fouls the plumage of seabirds and the fur of otters and seals. The most notorious accidents, such as the breakup of the Torrey Canyon in 1967 and the Exxon Valdez in 1989, linger in our collective memory, and few people are aware that seaborne oil transport has become vastly safer. Figure 10-5 shows that the annual number of oil spills has fallen from more than 100 in 1973 to just 5 in 2016. And the number of major spills fell from 32 in 1978 to 1 in 2016. The graph also shows that even as less oil was spilled, more oil was shipped. The crossing curves provide additional evidence that environmental protection is compatible with economic growth. It's no mystery that oil companies should want to reduce tanker accidents because their interests and those of the environment coincide. Oil spills are a public relations disaster, especially when the name of the company is emblazoned on a cracked-up ship, bring on huge fines, and of course, waste valuable oil. More interesting is the fact that the companies have largely succeeded. Technologies follow a learning curve and become less hazardous over time as the boffins design out the most dangerous vulnerabilities, a point we'll return to in Chapter 12. But people remember the accidents and are unaware of the incremental improvements. The improvements in different technologies unfold on different timetables. In 2010, when seaborne oil spills had fallen to an all-time low, the third worst spill from stationary rigs took place. The Deepwater Horizon accident in the Gulf of Mexico led in turn to new regulations for blowout preventers, well design, monitoring, and containment. In another advance, entire swaths of land and ocean have been protected from human use altogether. Conservation experts are unanimous in their assessment that the protected areas are still inadequate, but the momentum is impressive. Figure 10-6 shows that the proportion of the Earth's land set aside as national parks, wildlife reserves, and other protected areas has grown from 8.2% in 1990 to 14.8% in 2014, an area double the size of the United States. Marine conservation areas have grown as well, more than doubling during this period and now protecting more than 12% of the world's oceans. Thanks to habitat protection and targeted conservation efforts, many beloved species have been pulled from the brink of extinction, including albatrosses, condors, manatees, oryxes, pandas, rhinoceroses, Tasmanian devils, and tigers. According to the ecologist Stuart Pym, the overall rate of extinctions has been reduced by 75%. Though many species remain in precarious straits, a number of ecologists and paleontologists believe that the claim that humans are causing a mass extinction like the Permian and Cretaceous is hyperbolic. As Brand notes, no end of specific wildlife problems remain to be solved, but describing them too often as extinction crises has led to a general panic that nature is extremely fragile or already hopelessly broken. That is not remotely the case. Nature as a whole is exactly as robust as it ever was, maybe more so. Working with that robustness is how conservation's goals get reached. Other improvements are global in scope. The 1963 treaty banning atmospheric nuclear testing eliminated the most terrifying form of pollution of all, radioactive fallout, and proved that the world's nations could agree on measures to protect the planet even in the absence of a world government. Global cooperation has dealt with several other challenges since. International treaties on the reduction of sulfur emissions and other forms of long-range transboundary air pollution, signed in the 1980s and 1990s, have helped to eliminate the scare of acid rain. Thanks to the 1987 ban on chlorofluorocarbons, ratified by 197 countries, the ozone layer is expected to heal by the middle of the 21st century. These successes, as we will see, set the stage for the historic Paris Agreement on climate change in 2015. Like all demonstrations of progress, reports on the improving state of the environment are often met with a combination of anger and illogic. The fact that many measures of environmental quality are improving does not mean that everything is okay, that the environment got better by itself, or that we can just sit back and relax. For the cleaner environment we enjoy today, we must thank the arguments, activism, legislation, regulations, treaties, and technological ingenuity of the people who sought to improve it in the past. We'll need more of each to sustain the progress we've made, prevent reversals, particularly under the Trump presidency, and extended to the wicked problems that still face us, such as the health of the oceans and, as we shall see, atmospheric greenhouse gases. But for many reasons, it's time to retire the morality play in which modern humans are a vile race of despoilers and plunderers who will hasten the apocalypse unless they undo the Industrial Revolution, renounce technology, and return to an ascetic harmony with nature. Instead, we can treat environmental protection as a problem to be solved. How can people live safe, comfortable, and stimulating lives with the least possible pollution and loss of natural habitats? Far from licensing complacency, our progress so far at solving this problem emboldens us to strive for more. It also points to the forces that push this progress along. One key is to decouple productivity from resources, to get more human benefit from less matter and energy. This puts a premium on density. As agriculture becomes more intensive by growing crops that are bred or engineered to produce more protein, calories, and fiber with less land, water, and fertilizer, farmland is spared, and it can morph back to natural habitats. Eco-modernists point out that organic farming, which needs far more land to produce a kilogram of food, is neither green nor sustainable. As people move to cities, they not only free up land in the countryside, but need fewer resources for commuting, building, and heating, because one man's ceiling is another man's floor. As trees are harvested from dense plantations, which have 5 to 10 times the yield of natural forests, forest land is spared, together with its feathered, furry, and scaly inhabitants. All these processes are helped along by another friend of the earth, dematerialization. Progress in technology allows us to do more with less. An aluminum soda can used to weigh 3 ounces. Today it weighs less than 1/2 ounce. Mobile phones don't need miles of telephone poles and wires. The digital revolution, by replacing atoms with bits, is dematerializing the world in front of our eyes. The cubic yards of vinyl that used to be my music collection gave way to cubic inches of compact discs, and then to the nothingness of MP3s. The river of newsprint flowing through my apartment has been staunched by an iPad. With a terabyte of storage on my laptop, I no longer buy paper by the 10-ream box. And just think of all the plastic, metal, and paper that no longer go into the 40-odd consumer products that can be replaced by a single smartphone, including a telephone, answering machine, phone book, camera, camcorder, tape recorder, radio, alarm clock, calculator, dictionary, Rolodex, calendar, street maps, flashlight, fax, and compass, even a metronome, outdoor thermometer, and spirit level. Digital technology is also dematerializing the world by enabling the sharing economy, so that cars, tools, and bedrooms needn't be made in huge numbers that sit around unused most of the time. The advertising analyst Rory Sutherland has noted that dematerialization is also being helped along by changes in the criteria of social status. The most expensive London real estate today would have seemed impossibly cramped to wealthy Victorians, but the city center is now more fashionable than the suburbs. Social media have encouraged younger people to show off their experiences rather than their cars and wardrobes, and hipsterization leads them to distinguish themselves by their tastes in beer, coffee, and music. The era of the Beach Boys and American Graffiti is over. Half of American 18-year-olds do not have a driver's license. The expression peak oil, which became popular after the energy crises of the 1970s, refers to the year that the world would reach its maximum extraction of petroleum. Ausubel notes that because of the demographic transition, densification, and dematerialization, we may have reached peak children, peak farmland, peak timber, peak paper, and peak car. Indeed, we may be reaching peak stuff. Of 100 commodities Ausubel plotted, 36 have peaked in absolute use in the United States, and another 53 may be poised to drop, including water, nitrogen, and electricity, leaving only 11 that are still growing. Britons, too, have reached peak stuff, having reduced their annual use of material from 15.1 metric tons per person in 2001 to 10.3 metric tons in 2013. These remarkable trends required no coercion, legislation, or moralization. They spontaneously unfolded as people made choices about how to live their lives. The trends certainly don't show that environmental legislation is dispensable, By all accounts, environmental protection agencies, mandated energy standards, endangered species protection, and national and international clean air and water acts have had enormously beneficial effects. But they suggest that the tide of modernity does not sweep humanity headlong toward ever more unsustainable use of resources. Something in the nature of technology, particularly information technology, works to decouple human flourishing from the exploitation of physical stuff. Just as we must not accept the narrative that humanity inexorably despoils every part of the environment, we must not accept the narrative that every part of the environment will rebound under our current practices. An enlightened environmentalism must face the facts, hopeful or alarming, and one set of facts is unquestionably alarming: the effect of greenhouse gases on the Earth's climate. Whenever we burn wood, coal, oil, or gas, the carbon in the fuel is oxidized to form carbon dioxide, CO2, which wafts into the atmosphere. Though some of the CO2 dissolves in the ocean, chemically combines with rocks, or is taken up by photosynthesizing plants, these natural sinks cannot keep up with the 38 billion tons we dump into the atmosphere each year. As gigatons of carbon laid down during the Carboniferous period have gone up in smoke, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has risen from about 270 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution to more than 400 parts today. Since CO2, like the glass in a greenhouse, traps heat radiating from the Earth's surface, the global average temperature has risen as well by about 0.8 degrees Celsius, 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit, and 2016 was the hottest year on record, with 2015 coming in second and 2014 coming in third. The atmosphere has also been warmed by the clearing of carbon-eating forests and by the release of methane, an even more potent greenhouse gas, from leaky gas wells, melting permafrost, and the orifices at both ends of cattle. It could become warmer still in a runaway feedback loop if white, heat-reflecting snow and ice are replaced by dark, heat-absorbing land and water, if the melting of permafrost accelerates, and if more water vapor, yet another greenhouse gas, is sent into the air. If the emission of greenhouse gases continues, the Earth's average temperature will rise to at least 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial level by the end of the 21st century, and perhaps to 4 degrees Celsius, 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit, above that level or more. That will cause more frequent and more severe heat waves, more floods in wet regions, more droughts in dry regions, heavier storms, more severe hurricanes, lower crop yields in warm regions, the extinction of more species, the loss of coral reefs, because the oceans will be both warmer and more acidic, and an average rise in sea level of between 0.7 and 1.2 meters, 2 and 4 feet, from both the melting of land ice and the expansion of seawater. Sea level has already risen almost 8 inches since 1870, and the rate of the rise appears to be accelerating. Low-lying areas would be flooded. Island nations would disappear beneath the waves. Large stretches of farmland would no longer be arable, and millions of people would be displaced. The effects could get still worse in the 22nd century and beyond, and in theory could trigger upheavals such as a diversion of the Gulf Stream, which would turn Europe into Siberia, or a collapse of Antarctic ice sheets. A rise of 2 degrees Celsius is considered the most that the world could reasonably adapt to, and a rise of 4 degrees Celsius, in the words of a 2012 World Bank report, simply must not be allowed to occur. To keep the rise to 2 degrees Celsius or less, the world would, at a minimum, have to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by half or more by the middle of the 21st century, and eliminate them altogether before the turn of the 22nd. The challenge is daunting. Fossil fuels provide 86% of the world's energy, powering almost every car, truck, train, plane, ship, tractor, furnace, and factory on the planet, together with most of its electricity plants. Humanity has never faced a problem like this. One response to the prospect of climate change is to deny that it is occurring or that human activity is the cause. It's completely appropriate, of course, to challenge the hypothesis of anthropogenic climate change on scientific grounds, particularly given the extreme measures it calls for, if it is true. The great virtue of science is that a true hypothesis will, in the long run, withstand attempts to falsify it. Anthropogenic climate change is the most vigorously challenged scientific hypothesis in history. By now, all the major challenges, such as that global temperatures have stopped rising, that they only seem to be rising because they were measured in urban heat islands, or that they really are rising but only because the sun is getting hotter, have been refuted, and even many skeptics have been convinced. A recent survey found that exactly 4 out of 69, 406 authors of peer-reviewed articles in the scientific literature rejected the hypothesis of anthropogenic global warming, and that the peer-reviewed literature contains no convincing evidence against the hypothesis. Nonetheless, a movement within the American political right, heavily underwritten by fossil fuel interests, has prosecuted a fanatical and mendacious campaign to deny that greenhouse gases are warming the planet. In doing so, they have advanced the conspiracy theory that the scientific community is fatally infected with political correctness and ideologically committed to a government takeover of the economy. As someone who considers himself something of a watchdog for politically correct dogma in academia, I can state that this is nonsense. Physical scientists have no such agenda, and the evidence speaks for itself. And it's precisely because of challenges like this that scholars in all fields have a duty to secure the credibility of the academy by not enforcing political orthodoxies. To be sure, there are judicious climate change skeptics, sometimes called lukewarmers, who accept the mainstream science but accentuate the positive. They favor the fringe of the envelope of possibilities with the slowest temperature rise, note that the worst-case scenarios with runaway feedback are hypothetical, point out that moderately higher temperatures and CO2 have benefits in crop yields that should be traded off against their costs, and argue that if countries are allowed to get as rich as possible without growth-sapping restrictions on fossil fuels, they will be better equipped to adapt to the climate change that does occur. But as the economist William Nordhaus points out, this is a rash gamble in what he calls the climate casino. If the status quo presents, say, an even chance that the world will get significantly worse, and a 5% chance that it will pass a tipping point and face a catastrophe, it would be prudent to take preventive action, even if the catastrophic outcome is not certain. Just as we buy fire extinguishers and insurance for our houses, and don't keep open cans of gasoline in our garages. Since dealing with climate change will be a multi-decade effort, there's plenty of time to back off if temperature, sea level, and ocean acidity happily stop rising. Another response to climate change from the far left seems designed to vindicate the conspiracy theories of the far right. According to the climate justice movement popularized by the journalist Naomi Klein, in her 2014 bestseller, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, we should not treat the threat of climate change as a challenge to prevent climate change. No, we should treat it as an opportunity to abolish free markets, restructure the global economy, and remake our political system. In one of the more surreal episodes in the history of environmental politics, Klein joined the infamous David and Charles Koch, the billionaire oil industrialists and bankrollers of climate change denial, in helping to defeat a 2016 Washington State ballot initiative that would have implemented the country's first carbon tax, the policy measure which almost every analyst endorses as a prerequisite to dealing with climate change. Why? Because the measure was right-wing friendly, and it did not make the polluters pay and put their immoral profits to work repairing the damage they have knowingly created. In a 2015 interview, Klein even opposed analyzing climate change quantitatively. "We are not going to win this as bean counters. We can't beat the bean counters at their own game. We're going to win this because this is an issue of value."